I'm Declan Burke, and welcome to The Sit Down, the podcast that explores the mindsets, motivations, and opinions of the brands, agencies, rights holders, and elite talent working with Sport & Horse. Today's guest, Megan Henry, is a former D1 collegiate athlete in both field hockey and track. She then joined the Army, became a world-leading skeleton athlete competing for Team USA Skeleton and the Army World Class Athlete Program, with track records and a World Cup medal to her name. More recently, Megan won a Masters National Championship title in Olympic weightlifting, and she now coaches individual athletes to write their own stories and to become the successful high performer that she says is within us all. It was fascinating talking with Megan, who has faced challenges and adversity in her journey as an athlete, and I think you will enjoy her story so far, her insights, her positive mindset, and will come away feeling more energized than ever. Enjoy. Hi, Megan. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Not at all. Thanks for joining us on the Sit Down with Sport & Horse. So let's get started with the basic question of where you're from.
I am from Connecticut, born and raised. So obviously in the United States, relatively close to New York City. However, I don't sit still very long. So I'm very used to living out of a suitcase.
Okay. So moving all the time.
Yeah.
And actually, movement is an interesting theme because clearly I'm talking to you because you're an exceptional sports person. When did you get started with sport?
I started doing sports when I was really young. My father kind of pushed me into that nicely, gently, not forcefully. And I get my athleticism from my dad mostly. And my older brother also was into sports. So I kind of naturally pursued sport. And I was actually really, really shy as a kid. So I was really hesitant when I was participating in sport. But as I got older, I really found that, I had natural athletic gifts. And so I pursued sport seriously from middle school, which is about like preteen years in the US, very seriously in high school. I knew that I wanted to play sports in college. So I really focused my efforts primarily on field hockey as well as track and field. So my first like main sport love was actually field hockey. And I pursued that at a high level. And I mean, we can get into my whole sports career if you want, but
yeah, no,
that's where it started.
We'll touch on. Okay. So field hockey. So what do I know about field hockey? I know that your back must be pretty strong because you spend a lot of time running, in a kind of a bent over position, right?
Yeah. Luckily, I'm pretty short, so there's not a whole lot of ground for me to cover, so to speak. I don't have to bend over too far to be low to the ground. So you're running bent over. If you don't know too much about field hockey, the stick is rounded. It looks like a hook, like a candy cane, mm-hmm. and you only use one side of the stick. So one side is flat, the other side is rounded, and it's on a grass field or a turf. And yeah, I pursued that very heavily for many years. And so it's strange because once I graduated college, that was it. I never played field hockey ever again. And it was this thing I dedicated like all of my life to, and then it was just gone. That happens in all sport. I mean, I pursued sport even after field hockey, but you have that weird transitory period where it's like this thing that you spent all this time doing is just poof, it's just gone.
Very interesting. We started talking about movement and now we're talking about adaptation as well once you change from one to another. So this is interesting. So from field hockey, again, very aerobic, lots of bursts, but also good stamina required. And so on track, what was your discipline in track?
So I was a sprinter. It's crazy that I played field hockey because truly I am built for sprinting. I have short, explosive movements. And luckily in field hockey, there's kind of a lull. You're not going 100% of the time, but it does require those short bursts, but man, I felt like I was tired all the time because it just was not my strength. So in track and field, like indoor and outdoor, 100 meters mostly, 200 meters maximum, 4x100. I did long jump, but really temporarily, but short distances.
Okay, so let's take that at the D1 level because you were a D1 athlete. How did that influence then the rest of your athletic career? Because you're still going, right?
Yeah. So I played field hockey for all 4 years. That was my main focus. And then when I was done, because field hockey is a fall sport, I walked on to the track team because I just was like, I'm not quite done playing sports yet. It's my senior year. I'm going to graduate. I'm going to continue sprinting. I knew that I obviously was capable of doing that. I did it all through high school. I just didn't do it for all 4 years in college, which was great. It was great. It gave me another athletic outlet. And then when I was graduating from college, I still wasn't quite done being an athlete, but I actually joined the Army as soon as I graduated from college. And it was great because it provided the teamwork aspect. There was the physical and mental challenges, obviously the honor of serving your country. Like there was all of these aspects that were very attractive about it. And it also gave me the opportunity to go back to school. So I got my master's degree by serving in the military and have still these outlets that are quote unquote athletic, because there's still athletic things required in terms of tactical movement and all of that. So that was cool. I had to embrace the endurance running for a bit there. And when I first joined the military, I went through a series of training and everything, went through basic training and then advanced individual training. And my schooling was quite long. But in that time, I was actually recruited to try bobsled. And so my college strength coach was contacted by one of the, who's, she's still competing in bobsled, multiple Olympic medalist, Alana Myers Taylor. I went to school at American University in Washington, D.C., and she had graduated from George Mason, also in the Washington, D.C. area. So she was just contacting, you know, people in the vicinity, trying to pick athletes. Because in the United States, so USA bobsled and skeleton, there is two sports in one federation. The recruitment process, we're a little behind compared to some of the European countries. So we tend to pull from collegiate athletes, people who have a background in predominantly explosive sports. And so I was a good fit. And so I went to go and try bobsled. I was too small, however. So I weigh about 55 kilos, like 121 pounds or so. Okay. And they wanted me to put on like over 15 kilos, essentially. They wanted me to put on 30 to 50 pounds. And I was like, okay, I can't do that. And I'm also very short. So I'm small in stature. I actually ended up being one of the smallest women in the world competing in skeleton. So bobsled was just never going to work out for me. So I switched over to skeleton. So if you don't know what skeleton is, it is like luge, but head first. If you've ever seen the movie Cool Runnings, then you know what bobsled is. And so skeleton is one person going head first, laying on their stomach on basically a cookie tray, going down an ice track, and you hit like 80 miles per hour. You experience 5 G's of force. And
you've got to presumably keep your head up so that you can steer to a degree. Yeah.
I mean, for a large portion, you're really not seeing that much because of the pressure within the corners. And I mean, yeah, like you said, your chin is inches off of the ice. So the way we start the race is that you're pushing a weighted sled, and that's how you get the acceleration for the sled to get going. So they're looking for people who are explosive and strong. And I pushed one of the heaviest sleds in the field. So I had to be really strong and explosive to get this thing. I mean, you're generating it from the zero movement and having to generate all of that yourself and bring it up to speed at a full out sprint before you jump onto it going head first.
So obviously the physical demand there is huge, but I imagine the mental demand is also huge, right? I mean, apart from that explosiveness, then you're on, then you've got to try and have your wits about you, because at those
Definitely.
Kind of speeds, presumably a slip up could result in being sore.
Definitely. I've had my fair share of crashes. Concussion is one of the big injuries, so to speak, that comes from skeleton and bobsled. So skeleton requires, obviously, there's this huge explosive movement at the beginning. You know, you're generating a ton of power and explosion and getting the sled up to speed. Then you're loading onto the sled. So all of these athletic things. And then you have to somehow bring it back to being relaxed while going 80 miles per hour head first. So there's this very delicate balance between, you know, this explosiveness that's required, then immediately being relaxed and settling onto the sled, and also just being able to be very, very present so that you're able to execute while sliding. Because if your mind is elsewhere, or if it's thinking about, oh, I screwed up in that last corner, it shows up the rest of the way down the track and it shows up on your timesheet. So skeleton is usually two heats for a race. And the other interesting part about both bobsled and skeleton is you get three training days with two runs each. So six practice runs before a race. So six practice runs before you're expected to be an expert at this track and compete. And so it's not a lot of time, and you only compete from October to maybe the end of February, realistically. So it's like 6 months out of the year that you're doing this sport. And so that's very unique, because most other sports, like even if you were skiing and snowboarding, you could go somewhere else in the world and yeah. still be able to do it. And skeleton is not like that. And so it requires a lot of mental focus. And at the same time, for me, what I ended up incorporating was a lot of mindfulness to be able to help me stay present and let go of mistakes, and just being able to release tension, because obviously you're using centrifugal force and all of that. And so if you think that you're steering perfectly and steering in the right places, but if you're tense or you're holding any sort of stress in your body or in your mind, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how perfect your lines look. You're basically trying to force at that point. If you're trying to force like perfection, which is something I learned from early on in my career, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It really requires this like balance of being relaxed and like on the border of being out of control. So skeleton is very, very unique sport, I think, in the world that requires a very particular mindset to excel.
So the absolute physical, not tension, but the explosiveness followed by having to get into almost a state of zen. Yeah,
definitely.
They're almost like yin and yang. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. And with literally having to do that in a split second. That's an amazing skill set to have developed. So do you have an example of how that has benefited you in life off a track, for example, where you've had that explosiveness and then being able to be perfectly zen? I wish I had that.
I'm still human. Sometimes I like to think I'm superhuman, but I think, you know, our emotions, that's automatic, right? Sometimes we'll have an emotional response to something, whether that's someone says something to you and you have an emotional or aggressive response. And for me, I've noticed that, and this is through a lot of mindfulness and meditation, but also my experience in skeleton, I am able to quickly identify when I've had this emotional response and be able to like come back to a baseline, so to speak. So rather than like linger on this argument that I just had with my parents or whatever it is, you're my boyfriend, I tend to not linger on it, which is very different than, let's say, like 10 years ago. You start to notice in your body that you're having this reaction to something that someone triggered you and said. So it's just developed a level of awareness. And so for me, I'm able to come back to baseline much quicker. And then if I said something that I may have regret saying, I'm able to have that conversation very quickly and apologize or whatever it may be. So yeah, that is an interesting transition back to normal life and being able to recognize like, oh, I'm having this emotional response, and being able to have that awareness and turn into the observer. So like there's obviously a moment where, or even if you're scared or something like that is an instinctive response, right? There's not much that you're going to do to control that sort of impulsive response, but to be able to recognize it very quickly and come back to baseline is definitely something that I have developed and taken away from skeleton.
Okay, that's very cool. And you were competing, just so everybody listening knows, you were competing at a top level, kind of Team USA level, right? Yeah.
So yeah, I competed for over a decade for Team USA. I competed at the highest level. I was number one in the US for several years, and I won a World Cup medal. I had 2 track records. I was 8th overall in the world, was the highest ranking I ever had. And then I like just barely missed out on an Olympic team. I was an Olympic alternate for 2022 in Beijing. So I retired last season after the Olympics, and I knew that that was kind of coming. I had was kind of like, okay, this chapter is coming to a close for me. And so, yeah, it was a lot of things that I learned from that and competing at a high level that pushed me into my current endeavors, which have to do with mental performance and the sports psychology aspect, and it had to do with my own experience competing and just some of the tools that I developed. So I came from field hockey, obviously, which was predominantly a team sport. It was most of my athletic career was a team sport. Even though like I did track and field, skeleton was very different in the individual sport sense. And I liken it to like an MMA fighter. There's something very intense happening and you've got to keep your wits about you. It's a very different mindset than anything I have ever done competition-wise. I mean, even like golf. Golf requires a different mindset as well. But skeleton, because of the adrenaline associated with it, it is so unique. It really, really is. There's just nothing like it. So I had developed the interest in sports psychology while I was competing because I started to see the value and how it changed me throughout my career. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm transitioning into, and having that passion has really helped me. And I believe, you know, my experience competing and succeeding at the highest level, but also quote unquote failing at the highest level, it really has fueled me to help other people. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I did not make an Olympic team is because my focus had shifted from my personal performance, my process and all of that to the outcomes. And part of that had to do with, so because I'm in the military, I was not allowed to travel and compete during like the COVID years. Sure. So yeah. I was at like the peak of my career. That's when I was 8th overall in the world. I was World Cup medalist and number one in the US. And I was just really trending upwards. And then I was not allowed to train or compete. And so I was kind of just sitting around while everyone else in the world was competing. And it's the season before the Olympics, which was tough. It was really challenging.
Yeah, very tough, very tough.
And I mean, most people aren't like, yeah, let me take the season before the Olympics off, right? And so it does, it kind of messes with that trajectory, that momentum that you're generating. And so when I returned to competing, I was a little bit detached. We say like, okay, are you connected to your sled? And so I felt very disconnected from my sled because it's an extension of you. And so I really felt a little bit out of rhythm. And it was a transition to come back to the sled. And I was so attached to my previous accomplishments the season prior. So mm-hmm. I was like, well, I should be at this level. And I didn't really give myself the grace of being like, okay, well, you've stepped away for a year, so it's going to take a bit to come back to that. And so I had done all of this mental work, all of this introspection and all of this, and used some sports psychologists and mental performance coaches. And for whatever reason, I felt like, well, you know what? I should know better. So I'm like stressed and I'm holding on to these outcomes from last year, but like I should be able to get myself out of this. And so for anyone listening, do not be afraid to utilize your support system, because it would have helped me if someone had given me like the perspective shift of being like, okay, let's like bring it back and focus on the process. And I was doing that a bit, but I'd be like, okay, but the results aren't there and I need to be here. And last year I placed third here, so I should be third or better. And now that I didn't do that, I need these results. So I was really like all of that, those types of words, like I need, do I have to, I should, that's all a lot of pressure language. And so it Absolutely. Creates a lot of tension. So ultimately, I didn't end up making an Olympic team. It was very, very close. I missed out by 12 points, but I've learned so much from that experience. So while people might be like, oh my gosh, you know, you spent all these years and you didn't even make an Olympic team, but I learned so much more from not making it than I probably would have if I did make it. And I believe that makes me more relatable as a coach, that I know what that's like. And I do know what it takes to get to that and why I didn't do that. So I've learned a lot from it.
I completely agree with that. And I mean, recently when the Milwaukee Bucks were knocked out, Giannis was interviewed. I don't know if you've seen that interview. Yeah. And he's asked about, you know, well, do you consider the season a failure? Because they didn't make it. Yeah. And he was like, no. He was like, basically, there is no failure in sport. There's only learning. Yeah. But the principle is there. And there's a lot of stuff in the corporate world as well, which is all around that as well. It's like an IBM had this whole thing, fail, but fail fast, right? So it's about how failure actually isn't really failure. It's teaching us how to be successful. But without it, it's very difficult to know what's what. Yeah,
definitely.
I think you're spot on, basically. Everybody is human and absolutely everybody has setbacks in one way or another. So if you were a coach who had only ever achieved success, how can you possibly coach somebody when they have one of those setbacks?
Definitely. And it's interesting because in Olympic sports, you know, it's a 4-year cycle. So it's a lot of buildup to this one peak event. And yep. So it's interesting when you're dealing with people outside of that, like your friends and family who all mean very well, but they only see the once every 4 years thing. That's the only thing that they see. And like, well, I'm competing every single year, right? And I'm training years for this. And there's a lot that goes into it. And so initially, I definitely had that emotional reaction of when I did not make it, to be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I spent all this time and I didn't make it. So there was that emotional reaction. There was certainly the sadness that came with it and having to go through that emotional process and then be like, my career was not a failure because I did not make an Olympic team. Like, there are so many other things that I accomplished and learned in my career. So like, to have it all hinge on this one thing is not fair. It's not fair to me. And it's not fair to the people who supported me throughout my whole career, coaches, strength coaches, all of that. And so that was a perspective shift that I certainly had to go through after not making the Olympic team. But everybody goes through that. Everybody has that sort of experience, whether in sports or in the corporate world, like, oh, I didn't make that. I didn't get this promotion. Oh my gosh, you know. So it's interesting to have that emotional reaction, but to use better words and tell better stories. So for me, I had to tell a better story that, okay, I didn't make the Olympic team, but like, so what? Right? And just tell a better story.
I mean, to your point about hinging on one thing, you had an incredibly successful career across three different sorts of sports, right? And actually, still, for the listeners, it isn't over because you've done some Olympic weightlifting, right? And been successful at that. Right? So tell us a bit about that.
So after retirement, so the Olympics happened in February of 2022, and I already knew that my retirement was likely coming, whether I had made the Olympic team or not. And so it was very bittersweet. And so I spent a lot of time in rest and relaxation mode. I went on vacation. I did all these things that I hadn't done, because in elite sport like that, there's a very, I don't want to say poor, but there is not a life balance, right? It's very much tilted one way. So all of your decisions are based on this sport, because an athlete's lifespan at that level is relatively short in comparison to the rest of life, right? So for the longest time, you know, I wasn't going on family vacations. There was no ski trips. Obviously, I did a winter sport, but I wasn't doing anything. Like, I went away one time with my friends on a beach trip at the beginning of my off season when I wasn't training, and they wanted to go surfing. And I was like, no, I will not do anything that I could possibly get an injury from. There was a lot of things that I didn't do that supported my vision. That was my vision. That was my one thing that I was working towards. So everything was based around that. And so when I retired, I took advantage of like, well, now I can go on these vacations. I can hang out. I don't have to work out if I don't want to. Like, so I enjoyed that. And I gave my body the permission to rest and to indulge in foods that I hadn't been eating and all of those types of things, which was great. But I felt ultimately like something was missing. And so I was going to the gym and I was like, this is cool because I can work out to look good now, not for sports performance. Because in skeleton, I had to be heavier. So I was like training, I was eating a lot. And some people would be like, oh, I wish I had that problem. But it was tough. It was tough to be like really eating more calories than you feel comfortable doing and all of that, because I was a gravity sport. So I needed to be heavier. So like I said, I enjoyed the break, but my calling was to be an athlete. That's why I came to planet Earth. I expressed my gifts athletically. And so I felt very lost not having a goal. Mm-hmm. And so I had previously done Olympic weightlifting. We use Olympic weightlifting and strength and conditioning for skeleton just because of the power and explosiveness required. And so mm-hmm. I was like, you know what? I'm going to pursue that. I'm a master's age athlete. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. So I started training for that and getting back into that and brushing the rust off. So I decided that I was going to compete in just a local competition to get my feet wet and reacquainted with the competition scene. Yeah. And then compete at Masters Nationals Olympic weightlifting in the United States. It was absolutely great. I loved every minute of it. The first local competition went really, really well. I was surprised at how seamlessly I was able to like integrate back into a competitive environment after being away for nearly a year. And so it was very cool because obviously going into mental performance, I was able to implement these things that I teach other people. And I think that's awesome. And I think as a mental performance coach, it benefits me to be pursuing something athletically, even if it's not, you know, okay, I'm going to it for a national team, just to pursue something. So you're having to implement some of these tools that you're talking about. And so I was able to do that and I did really well in that local meet. And then I decided that I was going to drop two weight classes for the Masters National competition because I was like, I saw an opening and I was like, I can get a national title.
And you had to drop that weight in quite a short period of time, right?
I did. So that was tough. I did that local meet. It was like mid-January and Masters Nationals was literally 2 months later. So it was about an 8 week time frame that I dropped that weight and it was tough. I used intermittent fasting and extended fast to do it, which both of those things are great. However, in the short time frame, it's tough. It's tough to do that. It does a lot on your body. So for me right now, I like working out, but I'm not pursuing anything athletically just because I'm letting my body like come back to baseline because it is, it's very stressful on your body to do something like that. And I'm like, man, I don't know how these wrestlers are cutting weight like all the time. Like, oh my gosh, I give you guys all credit.
Yeah, we've worked quite a bit with MMA fighters and boxers and stuff like that. And particularly for the weigh-ins.
Yeah.
My heart goes out to every single one of them when it comes to weigh-ins because if they're trying to cut to make weight, and inevitably, immediately after the weigh-in, you see the big bottle of water, you know? I mean, it's just, it's a punishing regime, really.
Honestly, I don't know how they do it, like, on a regular basis, because it does, it's tough on your body. I will say that I was able to maintain energy. Obviously, I dropped a significant amount of weight in a short amount of time. So you lose muscle, you lose strength, and you lose leverage when you do something like that pretty aggressively. However, I felt really good in training. I was able to really keep my mind sharp and focused. I had a process. I was like, this is my purpose. This is how I show up to training. And I had used a lot of visualization, a lot of like affirmations and self-talk leading up to this competition and visualizing my success. So it was awesome. It was awesome to be able to implement those things again. And that is a very fun aspect of competing for me. And that's what makes competition very addicting for people. But I'm also able to use that and live vicariously through my athletes. So I don't have to be doing extreme weight cuts all the time now.
There's something else in the story which struck me that you had some potentially life-threatening blood clots at some point, right? So, I mean, talk about overcoming a challenge. That sounds incredibly scary. Do you want to enlighten us a bit about that?
Sure. So in 2012, at the end of the season, so this was in March 2012, I had just won national championships for skeleton. I was a national champion. It was one of the first like early years of competing for me. I had moved out to Utah at the time. I was training there and I was about to do a combine test. So I go to this combine. I'd been training all summer. I'm feeling really good. I'm like the strongest I have ever been. Still, even to this day, I was the strongest I have ever been at that combine. So I go to this combine test, which is basically an assessment, obviously, of your athleticism. It's like sprinting, agility, you're doing some jumps, max weight lifting, like max clean and a 3 rep max back squat. And I'm going to this event. And at this point, I'm a quote unquote veteran. And so there's a bunch of new people there. And I go to like jog a lap around the track to warm up and I could not breathe. I absolutely could not breathe. And I was like, well, this is going to be a really interesting day. I was like, I got to conserve my energy. So I complete this combine test. One of the first things is a 45 meter sprint. So if you've been training for any sort of sprinting, it's like, okay, 45 meters is not so bad, right? And so I do this 45 meter sprint and I essentially collapse at the end of this sprint and I'm gasping for air. And so everybody's looking at me, right? Like, what is wrong with this girl?
Yeah.
I somehow finished this whole combine test. Again, I did the best I've ever done to this day in terms of the lifts and everything. I squatted 123 kilos for three. And I was at, wow, I don't know, 57 kilo body weight. So I mean, it was very strong, right? I was like, I cannot do that now. I had the highest combine score out of the women that summer. And so I left this combine and I went straight to an urgent care. I was like, something is really wrong with me. And I'm like, everything that I've been doing is the exact same. I eat the same. I wake up at the same time. All my things are super regimented. But the one thing that I've changed is that I have started this birth control. And it was the NuvaRing, if anybody's interested. So I started to notice within 10 days of taking this that I just had a little bit of difficulty recovering. Like if I was sprinting, it would just take me a little bit longer to catch my breath. And so the average person may not have noticed something like that, but I started to notice and I was like, okay, what's going on here? And I'm like, well, there's been fires in Utah, so maybe that's it. One of my teammates has mono. Maybe I've got mono. So your mind does interesting things when it starts to justify, like, well, there's got to be an explanation for this, right? And sure. It just exponentially got worse the day of the combine, where it was so bad. My breathing was so labored that I wouldn't have been able to carry on this conversation. I just, there's no way that I could have even like been speaking. So, And I was just completely out of breath going upstairs. And so I end up flying from Utah to Florida, where my boyfriend at the time was. I saw a doctor there, and flying with blood clots, that's what I ended up having, was
not a good idea.
Very dangerous.
Yeah.
Super, super dangerous. Like it's the most risky thing you could do. So in the process of making it back to Connecticut before ideally going up to Lake Placid, which is where the Olympic Training Center is, and I'm seeing all these doctors like in the process. So I see some doctor in Utah. I fly to Florida. I see a couple doctors there. I fly to Connecticut. So I'm on the phone with my mom and I'm like, there's something really wrong. I need to see a pulmonologist. When I'm still in Florida, she's like, they can't get you in until this week. So I go home. I see another urgent care. I go to my like general practitioner and all of these people are like, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe you need an inhaler. Maybe you need this. Oh, take this antibiotic. You probably have a respiratory infection. And I'm saying the same story over and over again. I'm like, I started taking this birth control. This is the only thing that's changed in my life. And I see the pulmonologist and I'm telling the story. And he's like, well, you're a great storyteller. And so he's like, I'm afraid that you have blood clots in your lungs. And I hope that I'm wrong, but I need to rush you immediately to get a CAT scan because this is life-threatening. It's very dangerous. And he's just like, I hope that I'm wrong. And so this was in the evening. So they sent me to an after-hours imaging center. And so they bring me in, they do a CAT scan. And after that, they bring me in to do an ultrasound of my legs. And I'm sitting in this room and it's very dark for some reason. And they hand me a phone and it's the doctor on the phone, the pulmonologist. And he was like, Megan, I'm really sorry to tell you that you've got multiple bilateral pulmonary embolisms, meaning you've got blood clots in both lungs. It looks like somebody took paint and splattered it and you've got blood clots all throughout your lungs.
Oh my gosh.
And there's one off of the main branch of a pulmonary artery, which is why you've had such difficulty breathing. And it's caused an infarction, which means there's dead tissue of your lung. And so I just like, again, this emotional response that you can't help. I just immediately started hysterically crying because at first I was like, I don't even know what pulmonary embolism means, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was just absolutely hysterical. And my parents come and they're like, oh my, like how in the world did this happen? And so they rushed me to the hospital. I was in the hospital for 10 days. I was bedridden. I had to do heparin shots, which are, it's a blood thinner. You have to do these shots in your stomach. It is terrible, truly. Yeah. And then I was put on Coumadin at the time, which is a blood thinner. And now there's different medications for that. So it was very strange because I was gearing up for my season. I felt really great and felt very, very prepared physically. And then when I was released from the hospital, they were like, okay, you can walk for 10 minutes a day. You have this little like breathing machine that you can practice breathing into to increase your lung capacity. And gosh. I was like, oh my gosh, what in the world? So it was a huge contrast. Right? At the time I was training sometimes 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day. So it was very bizarre. And then I was in and out of doctor's offices because with Coumadin, you have to make sure the medication, the dosage is correct. And like your blood can't be too thin and it can't be too thick and you got to measure it. And so initially it was terrible. I was in and out of doctor's offices. I was just like, my life was truly upside down. And that was very challenging. And they had told me, the pulmonologist was like, you know, you may never be an athlete ever again. I'm like, I'm so sorry. And it was not a nice story at the time.
Yeah.
So for me to come through that, I was telling myself a different story. I was like, I'm going to be an athlete at some point. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I'm going to return to competing. They had said that I needed to be on blood thinners for a year. And I was like, I'm going to be off of these in 3 months. That didn't happen, but I was optimistic. Yeah. And I ended up being on blood thinners for about 8 months. So I did come off earlier than expected. And the whole time I was visualizing my own healing and recovery. That was what I kind of spent my time doing. And there were certainly bouts of depression, truly. It was very, very mentally challenging to be like, again, this was the year before the Olympic season.
Yeah.
2012 to 2013 is the season I sat out. So again, I came back into an Olympic season where I had left being the national champion. I came back. I was barely making the top 10 because people just leapfrog you. It was also early on in my career. So when you're early on in a career like that, your skills haven't quite been refined. And sure. So it was so challenging mentally for me. And I held on to the vision that like, I'm going to return to competing. I'm going to return. I am healthy. I can visualize my recovery. So it took a bit. I obviously didn't make an Olympic team then, but I did. I worked my way back up and I ended up making my first world championship team. And so there was a lot that did come from it and kind of like holding the vision of returning to sport and telling a better story. That's kind of where that initiated with me, like learning to tell a better story. And Napoleon Hill says that the greatest application of applied faith is learning the art of keeping your mind focused on what it is that you want. And that is so powerful. So yeah. A lot of people are focusing on what we don't want. And what I tell my clients and my athletes is like, well, what is it that we want? What do we want to put our energy towards? Because where your attention goes, energy flows. And, you know, you've got a good wolf and you've got a bad wolf. Which wolf are you feeding? I'm sure people have heard that before. Telling a better story. So while it didn't necessarily make me heal overnight, it certainly did better than if I had told the other story that I'm not going to be an athlete ever again. And I'm going to sit in my room and sulk and all of that. And there were days where I did do that. I did sit in my room and sulk.
Yeah.
But just reminding myself of like, this is the vision that I have, and holding to that vision and telling the better story certainly gave me a better outcome than if I hadn't done that. So yeah, I really encourage people to identify in times of struggle, like what is it that you want? And for you to be able, there's going to be a gap from where you are and where you want to be. But if you're able to focus on like, well, who do I have to become for this vision of mine that I want to be in my reality? Like, what can I do now to embody that person? What character traits do I need? For me, it was like, I needed to have faith. I needed to have faith and trust and just really disconnect from this outcome of returning and trust that it was coming rather than trying to like force that result. I was like, I know that I'm going to be an athlete at some point. I don't know when that is, but I know it's going to happen.
Wow, what a story. You basically got a PhD in overcoming adversity, you know?
I'm going to put that on my resume.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you do, yeah? I mean, clearly you have a lot of the theory really well done, but you've also lived it all a couple of times. So, you know, that makes for a very powerful combination.
Thank you.
Well, I've been learning a lot and thoroughly enjoying it, and I'm amazed at your energy. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
So speaking of energy and maybe lightening it up slightly, what do you do for fun? Are you allowed to have fun?
So I was talking to my boyfriend about this the other day, actually. I was like, what would you say that my hobbies are? And he was like, well, meditation.
Okay.
I do enjoy meditation. I am a huge fan of Dr. Joe Dispenza. And so I just actually signed up for one of his meditation retreats in the fall. And I'm really excited about that. Oh my gosh, he's unreal. He is just a legend. He's very good at balancing the like woo-woo side of meditation and all of that with the actual science and the quantum physics and all of the theory that goes behind it, which is awesome. So I do love that. I love to travel. My boyfriend lives in the UK, and okay. So I travel quite a bit. And because in skeleton, like I competed all over the world, but you're going to the same locations over, there's only so many tracks in the world. So while that was awesome and I got to see the world and experience other cultures and things like that, now I'm like, well, I can go to places that are warm. So I really, really enjoy traveling. I really enjoy food, trying different foods and cultures. And I really have been a lifelong learner. So I really like learning about the things that I'm passionate about. So I really, really do like learning about like mindset and all of that. I just absolutely devour that information. As nerdy as that sounds, those are my hobbies, I guess.
No, listen, it's whatever makes you happy, right? And the beautiful thing about the world is the diversity that it has. Let's say there's a movie made about you at some point. Who plays you? Who would you pick?
Oh my gosh. This is a great question. Okay. I would have to say probably Scarlett Johansson.
Okay. Nice choice. Yeah. I thankfully ask these questions. I don't answer them. So in all those sports, did you ever have a single sporting hero that who you really thought was amazing?
For a long time, actually, I really liked Ronda Rousey and Conor McGregor. Those are controversial people nowadays, but Ronda Rousey, her mindset and her story was very relatable to me as well. Mm-hmm. She had these highs and lows. And I mean, while she was still amazing in the Olympics, she didn't quite reach her goal. She went through a period where she was in this like lull. I mean, she was drinking and like all these other things. I didn't quite do that. So that's good. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. And then was able to be like, I'm going to reignite this vision of mine. And she really did bring like the UFC, MMA women, like really, really brought that to the scene. And her mindset, I really, really resonated with. And it was very inspiring to me when I was younger. And same with Conor McGregor. I am actually more of an introvert. So I'm actually an extroverted introvert. And I really did relate to like the MMA fighters, the UFC fighters who have this cockiness to them. I really liked that. I personally don't do that, but I was like, I really like that. And I want to embody that mentality on the inside, even if I'm not expressing it in the same way as like a Conor McGregor. And early on, I loved that Conor McGregor. He told the story. He kept the vision of the things that he wanted. He kept them at the front of his mind, and he was able to execute and bring those things into his reality. And he's an excellent example, whether you like him or not, whether your taste in him has changed over the years. He really, really was excellent at doing that. And that was so inspiring to me. And I love like the underdog mentality that ties into like the fighters, because I felt like that was me. I felt like I'm an underdog, but you know, I come here and I execute and I always perform on race day. And so those are two people that really inspired me. There's people like within Olympic weightlifting, Ilya Ilin, if anybody knows who that is, Kakius Philly. And yeah. That's really it. I'm certainly inspired by other athletes in all arenas and gymnasts and Lindsey Vonn, Michaela Schifrin. But I would say those two, Ronda Rousey and Conor McGregor, really, really inspired me early on in my career. Like I read Ronda Rousey's book. I read John Kavanaugh's book. And yeah, those are two people that really influenced me.
Absolutely great choices. And also complex enough for both of them, because to some degree, I mean, MMA, it's well established now, but they were kind of part of it as it was beginning to grow. So it was becoming less niche and more mainstream, if I can say that. Yeah,
definitely.
So just a couple of basic questions I always ask around your day-to-day habits. So kind of brands that you'd use or eat or consume or hydration or anything. So, you know, what do you like wearing?
I mean, I wear a ton of athletic clothes. I feel like I live in athletic clothes, but I'm transitioning. So I was using Curves and Combat boots for a long time. It's a military, a veteran owned brand. Uh-huh. But now I'm transitioning to wearing stuff that is more like cotton. And I'm trying to find brands. So if you are out there and you know brands that are leaning towards being 100% cotton, let me know. Or 95% cotton. I'm transitioning some of the stuff that I'm wearing and consuming to be like healthier to me. There's just been studies shown on using Lycra and all of that synthetic stuff that is, I've been wearing leggings for, I don't know, my whole life practically. So it's interesting, like the health aspects that can be tied to the things that you're wearing. I know that probably sounds very woo-woo and out there. As far as food, so I'm very animal-based, and so I eat a lot of like animal grass-fed, grass-finished foods. I love Kerrygold butter. Yeah, and fruit and things like that. So I eat relatively clean. I certainly have a sweet tooth. So I don't really have like brands that I'm like super attached to. I really like coconut water. Harmless Harvest has an excellent coconut water that tastes amazing, or Whole Foods has their own brand. But yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about like, well, what are these brands that I'm super identified with?
So on the sweet tooth bit / cheat meal, if there was such a thing as a cheat meal in your world, what would that be? Would it just be lots of dessert?
I'd have a bellyache, but I would love a lot of dessert. So for me, I really love lobster. So lobster roll is a must. If you know the difference between a Connecticut style and Maine style, Connecticut is the way to go. So Connecticut is a hot lobster roll with butter. I highly recommend it. Maine does colds with like a mayo lobster salad, and it's all right, but the hot with butter is the way to go.
A completely non-biased view, of course. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So I am gluten-free. I do that by choice just for inflammation and recovery and all of that. I started to do that as an athlete, and I felt better. So I just kept doing that. But if I were to indulge in some gluten, a really good pizza, particularly while in Italy, is something that I would indulge in. And I absolutely love chocolate mousse and chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. Must-haves.
Okay, great. So I guess in terms of a sort of a wrap up in my head, primary career right now is essentially helping people and athletes, right?
So definitely, yep.
It's clear, I would think, to anybody who's listening to this podcast that you've got all the theory, you have the PhD in overcoming adversity, and you're obviously very articulate and have great energy. So to me, it should be a no-brainer for somebody who's looking for help, or maybe even they don't think they need help, but has listened, can see a way in which there could be a benefit, yeah, to the kind of the coaching that you can provide. So who are you willing to coach, I guess, is a question I would have. Do they need to be in a particular time zone? Do you care? What? How does that work? Are there types of sports you prefer? Or?
So for me, I am a world traveler, so time doesn't matter for me. As long as we can coordinate something on my schedule, we can make it work for sure. So ideally, I'm working with athletes. I will work with other people because I believe that everybody is a high performer, and it's just that you have to unlock that. So we're all high performers on planet Earth. So I work with any athletes. I don't have a preference in sport. I feel like because I really only honed in on like field hockey, track, and skeleton, that's a small niche to pull from. So I will work with any athletes. Mindset is, it's universal, and mindset is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, and that applies to all sports. So I'm super interested. I feel like the most value I give is for somebody who wants to play in college or wants to go pro, and they just feel like maybe their confidence isn't quite there. I help them utilize their words to tell better stories, to feel more confident, and to use the power of their subconscious mind to bring their reality, their desired reality, to them. And so, yeah, I'll work with anybody anywhere.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, listen, just to say a very big thank you from me for taking time to chat with us, Megan. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm quite
thank
sure everybody
you.
Who listens will thoroughly enjoy it as well. And we'll ensure your contact details are available to everybody. For those listening, you'll hear it in the wrap-up in a minute, but you can contact us at Sport Endorse, and we'll very happily put you directly in touch with Megan. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to Megan for giving us her time and for sharing her insights. If you've enjoyed listening, give us a like and leave a comment on the podcast provider of your choice. We appreciate your support. Speaking of support, if you're an athlete looking for some support in ensuring you've the right mindset to write your own story and enjoy the successes you envisage, let us know and we can connect you with Megan. Reach out to us by email at hello@sportendorse.com or DM us via social media. Until next time, take care and be relentless.